Cheers.
Cheers, Sean.
Welcome to the first M-Spoke podcast. Today I have Andreas Weigen with me, who was the chief scientist at Amazon and is currently a teacher at Stanford and some other places as well. Andreas also helps a number of startups, including M-Spoke, in the area of helping them understand people and data. Andreas, what other things should we know about you?
What other things? So I was born in Germany. I did my undergrad in physics. In those days, it was trying to understand how particle physics, in these high-energy physics particles, how they interact with the world. In the 90s, I then, as assistant associate professor at NYU in the business school, I moved to understanding how traders interact with the world. And then when the web came along, I started a company called Mood Logic, where we created metadata for music data. And then, as you said, I went to Amazon.com as chief scientist to understand how people interact with the world, how people interact with e-commerce, and then more recently, with some work I've done at MySpace, for instance, how people interact with people.
Excellent. And you say you help startups understand people and data. What kind of data are you talking about?
Well, we can say that data come in three flavors. The first flavor of data, the digital exhaust. People leave whatever they do in the digital world. It can be the GPS device or your mobile phone as you were driving up to San Francisco, which had to talk to cell towers, so cell towers had to know where it was, otherwise your mobile phone wouldn't have rang on the freeway. Another example of these implicitly collected data would be any e-commerce site, where you tell the site what you're interested in, and then the site plays the next move in the game and shows you a few options, and then you click on whichever option you prefer. So again, all these actions you did are interactions between you and the system. So that's the first source of data. The second source of data are data which you provide about yourself deliberately. It could be, for instance, which kind of podcasts you're interested in, or it could be what your preferences are on a dating site. Or it could be data about yourself. Think about Facebook. So those are relatively easily changed and do not have the revealed preference character the data of the first kind had. What is relatively new and was pioneered by Facebook, MySpace, Friendster, etc., by the social networks, is the third kind of data, which is not primary data about yourself or about somebody else, but is data about the relationship between you and other people. So sometimes I say the first and the second source of data is about the nodes in the network, whereas the third source of data is about the arcs in the network. And the network you have, the relationships you have with people, is much harder to emulate than attributes about yourself, which you can just change within a couple of seconds.
Excellent. And how does this data apply to M-Spoke?
So M-Spoke faces the problem of discovery in the blogosphere. So I used to say that the 90s was given a certain set of data, what are the insights you can get? Whereas this decade is given a certain problem, what data can you get in order to solve that problem? So the problem of discovering blog posts is, well, what kind of data can I get the user to contribute so he or she sees that their life will be a better life? Easier life, simpler life, more interesting life, if they only give us some data about their blog reading behavior right now. And that could be that they annotate a blog post, that they tag it, or it could be that they forward it to a friend, they want to save it. Such data allow us to have much more powerful relevance functions than if we just look at, say, the words in the post.
Excellent. So you've been doing some work with us where you've helped us develop a dashboard to evaluate our system. Can you talk a little bit about that work?
Hey, you are the boss. I don't know how much I can talk about the work. So, I mean, a dashboard or metrics is, of course, for me, the very central grid, which allows us to know how well we are doing. And sometimes when I work with large companies, it is fascinating how for them, the metrics, they call them key performance indicators, tend to be just something like global sales and stuff like that. But for us, those metrics are, as you know, extremely fine-grained, highly granular piece of information where we know if in an experiment we change a certain parameter by a little bit, well, will, for instance, the number of blog posts that person is reading or the number of blog posts that person is forwarding to somebody per time unit, if that's what matters, will it increase or decrease? So one of the things I found really good at MSpoke is that people have the mindset of saying, hey, we don't know what the one true metric is, but we can be creative and invent 20 or 30. And then as we tweak the system, as we play around, as we have ideas, we see how those ideas actually affect the various and sundry metrics. And some of them go up if up is better, others go down if down is worse. And understanding those trade-offs, I think, is key to understanding the system.
Excellent. So let's just pause it for a moment and talk about what we want to talk about next. So, awesome. So let me just take a moment and talk a little bit about how we're using those metrics to improve FeedHub and also some of the APIs that we're offering to our customers as well. For people who may not be familiar with FeedHub, people who maybe stumbled upon this podcast because of Andreas's background and being a fan of his, FeedHub is really an application for people who are users of RSS readers. So tools like Google Reader and Bloglines and NetNewsWire. And the problem that that audience has is they tend to subscribe to far more feeds than they actually can keep up with. So they go to a blog post, that blogger links to another blogger and they say, oh, I should subscribe to that. And then that blogger links to a New York Times Bits article and they say, oh, I should subscribe to that as well. And next thing you know, they're subscribed to hundreds or even thousands of feeds, but they can maybe actually keep up with 10 or 20 or 50 of them. So every couple of weeks, what do? They look at their RSS reader. They have way more items on read than they can keep up with. So they declare what we call RSS bankruptcy and they mark everything as read and start again. What we say is time to stop RSS bankruptcy. And that's what FeedHub lets them do. We say those 10 or 20 feeds that you're already reading everything from them, continue to read them. But the rest of those posts where there's some signal to noise ratio, give us those sources and we'll give you back the most relevant posts back to you using exactly the kind of data that Andreas talked about. We'll take advantage of looking at your behavior with the recommendations that we're making to you. So are you forwarding posts to friends? We also have the ability for you to give explicit feedback like thumbs up and thumbs down, and even give us sources of your digital identity on the web, which we can use to learn about you. So Andreas can use the posts he writes on Wigan.com as a way for us to understand the topics of information that he's most interested in. Now, I think what's important though is that this system, this platform, is actually great beyond just FeedHub. Sites are using this to add this implicit functionality to their behavior because while the RSS reading problem and the information overload there we think we've solved with FeedHub, this is actually a problem people have across the web. There's way more information than we can keep up with today. And if you're a user on Facebook trying to keep up with your news feed or trying to keep up with all the different tweets that your friends are making on Twitter, or you're going to your favorite magazine or magazine's website and you just can't keep up with all the great content that's being created for your domain, you realize that there's way more content on the web and information is exploding at a rapid pace and there's way more information than you can possibly consume. So what a lot of sites are now having us do is help them create and deliver only the most relevant content for their users as well. So let me talk about one example of how a site is using that quickly, and then we'll give Andreas an opportunity to weigh in as an expert as well on this. So Reed Business is one of the large B2B media companies on the web, and they are trying to help supply chain professionals with one of their groups of publications. And so you have all these supply chain professionals who are doing things like managing logistics and supply chains, and they just, there's lots of information being written that's relevant for them. Some of that information is being written by Reed. Some of that information is being written by supply chain professionals or vendors who maintain blogs themselves. And Reed's realized that they're no longer able to control all the information that's important for their users, but they are a trusted source. So what they've done to work with us is they've launched a site called Supply Chain Daily. And if you're a supply chain professional, you'll probably find that interesting. If not, it probably won't be the most interesting thing. I always say a good sanity check is, are forklifts interesting to you or not? If they're not interesting to you, Supply Chain Daily is probably not your site. But we've gone out and we've aggregated all these different posts from across the live web, and we understand a little bit about you when you sign up, and then we look at your behavior with that, with the content we're recommending to you from the initial information you give us when you sign up. And every day you get more and more relevant information, in this case delivered to your inbox. So it's not an RSS reader, it's instead an email that's delivered to you every day. And as you get more and more relevant content delivered to you, it ends up becoming your de facto source. So actually users who we've interacted with in user studies who use Supply Chain Daily say, you know, I open my email in the morning, I take my cup of coffee, and I read Supply Chain Daily to tell me what I need to know, what's going on in the world that I should be talking to my boss about, that I should be talking to my vendors about, or that I should be thinking about doing on my factory floor. That's obviously one example from lots of different publishers and new media companies that are taking advantage of the platform that we've created. But I think that it gives you a good example of how this problem of solving information overload, which again, some of the dashboard work that we've done with Andreas is continuing to improve and get better and better every week and measured progress, how that's being taken advantage of in lots of other people who may not use an RSS reader. So FeedHub may not be the way to change their behavior. So Andreas, I'm curious what you think about this strategy of letting lots of people take advantage of this common powerful platform.
All right. Before answering that question, sure, let me actually reframe the problem or re-ask a question. Why do we care about information? The fact that United Airlines flight 888 from Beijing was late today. Well, from information theoretic perspective, there's not information there because it's all simple. But even if there was information, I frankly probably wouldn't care. Unless a friend of mine, of course, wasn't that flight, I would pick him up. So the point I want to make is, information, well, okay, Shannon came from a certain perspective. If you want to build modems, that's a good thing. If you want to do cryptography, that's a good thing too. But the perspective I like to have is, how can we support the decision-making process of people? So if you think about Amazon.com, Amazon doesn't primarily view itself as a company that tries to push books down your throat, but as a company that says, hey, we help you make decisions. Decisions which might end up you not buying this book, hopefully another one though. And it might end up you not buying this book from Amazon, hopefully yet from somebody else on our platform. So that decision-making, which should be supported by the site, that deep idea, I think, should also be transferred to an RSS reader. So there's lots of stuff out in the world I'm kind of interested in. And I know that even if I read all of today's papers, I probably will die before I'm done with reading all of today's papers. So that's not a very feasible algorithm and won't help me make much in terms of decisions. So the perspective I'm really pushing is, how does the information people are gathering help them to make the decisions? I'm not talking about religion. I mean, religion is probably not based on data, but pretty much everything else is. Think about your dating decisions, or your financial decisions. You know, all these decisions are made in a large area of uncertainty. You don't know what you want. You don't really know what the other person is about. And You don't really know how the world is going to develop. Still, you have to make a decision. You know, are you going to hang out with them or not? So, going back to RSS readers, I think if we manage to reframe the problem of what decisions does the user have to make and what helps him or her to make those decisions, then actually we do a better job than just trying in the abstract helping them get information they might be interested in.
Yeah, I would agree with that actually. I think the interesting thing about people who are using RSS readers versus the user studies we've done with people who are using our product on some other platforms is that they rarely actually have the problem of discovering sources. It's actually quite easy for them to end up with lots and lots of information. So unlike maybe a user who is on Supply Chain Daily, just because we've already talked about that, where they're just blown away that some of this content even exists. It's where we're unearthing new content for them. In the case of people who are really active feed readers, and it's a small percent, you know, 4 to 10% of the web uses an RSS reader actively, the interesting thing about them is that they actually tend to have a pretty good sense of the type of contents out there. And because the gesture is so easy to add it to the set of sources they're subscribed to, it's one quick gesture for them to do that, they end up with quite a large repository of the type of content that they could be interested in when they're in that mode. Now, certainly when you're in other modes, which they wouldn't perceive to be a mode that they would try to solve their information, they would try to solve with their RSS reader, they may be very interested in discovering new sources. So for example, if they're visiting a new city and they wanted to find a hotel or a yoga studio, that they would actually look at a search engine to solve that problem for. But the type of material that they're trying to get through their RSS reader, they really don't have a problem discovering new sources. The problem is when they don't keep up with their sources, they end up missing so much that the act of highlighting relevant content for them feels like an act of discovery.
So one of the questions I often ask clients is, what is the alternative? And if the alternative is to just delete all the emails I got because I'm not catching up, then maybe having some algorithm which surfaces those I should be reading, maybe because they come from people who have enjoyed reading emails from before, or they might be coming from my boss, not that I have one, but they might be coming from a boss.
This conceptual boss out there for you.
So I think the question always is, what is the alternative? And in many cases, having a baseline algorithm, or let's say, if you do product recommendations, the alternative might be that you just show whatever somebody else just bought in the last hour. Can you do better than that? And for sure, in the RSS space, in the blog space, in the post space, you can do way better than having the random meandering through the high-dimensional hyperspace of information. And I think that's what we need to look at. Let me look at it in a different way. Funnily, and I'm probably the only one in the world, my computer gets worse the more I use it. On the other hand, Amazon.com, Google, MSpoke gets better the more I use it. So what's going on here?
Or you use a PC.
What's going on here is that if over time the predictive model gets trained, the predictive model of what are relevant documents on Google, what are relevant recommendations in a given context, in a given situation at Amazon, and what are given recommendations in a given context in RSS reader, over time you have more and more data that allow you to aggregate in a very smart way across users. So, the power of MSpoke is, and that actually is also reflected in its API strategy, the power of MSpoke is that it says, look, there are so many parameters you could set. And if you are a company which has only maybe 10% or 1% of the data which we have, which we see, then you have a much harder time figuring out what you should be recommending. We all know the long tail. And you just don't reach into the long tail if you don't have the ability to aggregate across sites, to aggregate across users. You don't really know how to represent an article if you haven't seen it. If you've seen it a couple of times, it might have been random. If you have 100 times more people, then you have seen it a couple of 100 times, and you can say much more about it. So that notion of data strategy, which was crucial at the beginning of Amazon.com, then Amazon actually powered AOL's recommendations. And poor AOL, what could they do but share the data which people at AOL are clicking on with Amazon, because otherwise Amazon couldn't send recommendations. So that's a very smart data strategy. Not contractually, you have to give us the data you're getting from your users. No. Hey, if you want us to help you, you need to share us data. And that's the same idea here behind Hemspoke, and that's part of the reason I'm working with you. Because having that power of a really good, well thought through data strategy is, in my eyes, in this world, which is not primary data, not primarily determined by the quality of algorithms, but in most cases by the creativity of data collection, is a key competitive advantage.
I think that's a great point. And it also transitions to one other type of API, which we've actually sort of backed into offering, to be honest with you. So we always assumed that people would take advantage. Grabbing another glass of wine here as we have fun with the podcast. We always knew, though, that people would probably want to leverage our recommendation engine for recommending content, in the case of the Read example that I talked about. What I don't know that we realized, and the markets really pulled us into this offering, is helping people who are already aggregating or already have a lot of data but are having trouble making sense out of that data. And they've said, hey, I've looked at FeedHub, and one of the things I've realized is that you guys know an awful lot about each of these posts, right? You know how popular it is from different partners that you have. You know some topics that it's on. You know what Wikipedia category it's most like. You know companies and people's names that are prominently talked about in the article. So not just mentioned in passing, but this article really is about Andreas, not just mentions his name, or this article really is about Bill Gates or Michael Jordan, and maybe it can disambiguate between, is this about Michael Jordan, the statistician, or Michael Jordan, the basketball player? It's always interesting to see which Michael Jordan the person thinks about first when you talk about this example. But so it's interesting. So we do this well. We do this because you have to have good data, but lots of other people have said, boy, I would love to give you my content and you provide us back the metadata you know about that. As one of our business development advisors says, it's sort of metadata as a service, or what we call MSense, because it senses what the content is about and gives that data back. And let me just talk about one example of how a customer's using this. So NewsGator, which is probably best known as an RSS reader, ironically, was one of the first people to pull us into this market. NewsGator actually makes a lot more of their money by providing widgets to publishers. So USA Today or The Washington Post might take advantage of them to take their content and take their RSS content, and what they like to say, put that RSS content in a dress, or dress it up and make it easy for it to be shared across the live web. And so NewsGator has always wanted to provide a related content widget as one of their offerings for their publishers, so that not only when you go to the USA Today site, isn't there a widget that says, hey, add this to your iGoogle page, but there's also on each of the articles a widget which says, here are some other related articles from USA Today and from our partners that might be interesting to you, even if they don't know anything about you, even if it's the first time you've come to that site. And so NewsGator is working with us to create this widget. We've blogged about it a little bit, both on the MSpoke and NewsGator blog. And what they've done is they've taken the metadata we have about the content, so the metadata we have about that article on USA Today, and also looked for where is that metadata also in the other content they're aggregating to put in that related content widget. They've married that with some of the other data they have in their system, like how many people are clicking on or forwarding articles. So how popular is the data, which by the way, we use those same popularity scores in FeedHub. But they've married those two things together, and they've ended up creating really compelling ways to recommend related content, very similar to what you might have seen on a Sphere or some of the other tools that are out there that have been doing this for a while. So neither NewsGator or MSpoke would claim this is a new use case, but I think the interesting thing is the marrying of our really excellent understanding and sensing of what content's about through our product that we call MSense, which we offer as an API, and NewsGator's understanding of popularity through the millions of people using their RSS readers and widgets, we've been able to create what many publishers are finding is a much more compelling way to recommend related content to people. So I think it's, I sort of started on this because you talked about sort of the data and having a data strategy and how it's interesting to develop good data about content. And it's interesting, you do need this data to do it well. We needed it to do our recommendation engines well, but we're also seeing lots of other people who need it for lots of other purposes, like NewsGator's taking advantage of it today. Right, so we've talked about MSense and how people are using this for lots of different services. You know, over a decade ago, people started, recommendation engines probably came to the forefront of people's minds with Amazon launching their recommendation engine. How have recommendation engines in your mind changed in the last decade, or have they?
Recommendations. So if we talk about product recommendations, I think one of the shifts in my mind, at least, have been that we moved pre-Amazon to Amazon from static data about the person that I live in 94114 zip code here and I'm a single male to dynamic recommendation, which at least looked at my past purchasing behavior, but then which tried to understand the situation am I in. Am I in a situation where I greatly care what textbook I'm going to pick for my student the next quarter? Or hey, you know, I'm just going to read this book or to order this book. Maybe I get one idea out of it. It's worth the $50 already. But the real change, I think, in recommendations has come through the third data source, which we described before. Namely, not notes, not things about myself, but through the relationships I have. Facebook, in my perspective, clearly pioneered through newsfeed the notion that my friends are interested in something, are looking at something, and hey, that is a damn good reason of why I might be looking at it as well. Amazon had that feature called Share the Love, where once you've bought a book, you could actually give a couple of email addresses of your friends who, if at least one of them bought that book within a week, got 10% discount on the book, you got 10% credit, and Amazon sold another couple of books. So the power of the social graph for recommendations is not to be underestimated. I'm teaching a course at Haas at the Berkeley Business School called Marketing 2.0. And what it is about is trying to understand how these traditional sources or problems of marketing, like pricing, promotions, product, and so on, how they have totally been changed by the web. So the social graph of recommending things which your friends have bought or looked at or found interesting is more powerful than I think all of traditional marketing taken together. You might know that in, I think, 2003, Amazon's marketing department was fired, period. No marketing department anymore because it just didn't get to the same results per dollar spent as Amazon got by the automatic algorithms based on the purchasing behavior and the clicking behavior of people. Now, there was a study with a major carrier in the United States where two things were compared. One was that all these fossil data of people's year of birth and so on and so forth, how often they have been married, how many children they have, which doesn't change all that often. We're compared, and these people are good statisticians, to be really clear, really good statisticians who know how to build such models, was compared to simply marketing that new product, that communication product, to people who call people who bought that product. You know, not nuclear science, not brain surgery. And it turned out that the lift was about 4.8 times as large. So in this world, and now I want to link it back to M-Spoke, of this plethora of information, what are we left with? We are left with those people who we trust. We're left with those opinions which filtered already the plethora of information out on the web. And that is our social graph. So that means that people tend to distrust organizations. People tend to distrust the government, companies. But people tend to believe their friends. So that factor of 5, in some cases a factor of 10, which social recommendations have for products, I believe is also true for social recommendations for content. So it is not, if you think about what is an individual, that we're just, you know, one person. I might, you know, have a number of sub-interests, and one of the things which is definitely uncool in this world is to post somebody's profile, which you saw on that dating site or as an anonymous profile at Craigslist, than to repost it and say, hey, I think, you know, at the University of California at Berkeley, I think this is my professor's profile on Craigslist. So we have those silos, those sub-segments of our personality. And an example, a friend of mine at the conversation group always gives us, he has 5 daughters between 12 and 18. He's interested in other people with 5 daughters between 12 and 18 because he wants to buy a car, and he is not interested in a car some single guy in the cast is going to buy, but what car are people buying who have 5 daughters that age group? So when we talk about social recommendations, it can be either recommendations which are based on actions who people take who we know personally, newsfeed on Facebook, or it can be actions who are taken by people who are currently in a similar situation from us. And that power, I think, about understanding the interactions between people goes way beyond what traditional marketing, traditional recommendations, be it for product, be it for content, have ever dreamt of. And if we really think what has changed in the last years, it is that dramatically, radically new forms of communication have arisen. Take Twitter as an example. So in Twitter's case, where, you know, you send tweets and people have different ways of Twittering, and whoever wants to follow you follows you. You don't have any control over that. And if for some reason you're not interesting enough for them anymore, then they stop following you. So I think Twitter is an interesting example for discovery.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting example as well. We actually I think the interesting thing is looking at ways that it's similar and that it's different from maybe other kinds of recommendations. You know, one of the things I think that's interesting about Twitter is, at least at this point, there's sort of just a fire hose of content from the people that you're following, right? And so maybe there's a filtering problem there. Maybe that's something at some point M-Spoke will focus on. But immediately, one of the things that's become important, I think, is figuring out the right sort of people to include in your fire hose of content, right? And a guy who I know you're another company that you're advising, and somebody that I've gotten to know really well, Steve Mingyao, is been working on this problem a lot with an app called Mr. Tweet. And we're big fans of that app at M-Spoke. I'm a huge fan of it personally. I've told Mingyao that. But I think it's interesting because it's really taking a people discovery problem, right? Which is a problem that he's been working on for a long time. Both he and you have talked to me about it. And frankly, in other contexts, it's almost actually felt a little dirty. Like, I don't know that I want people discovering me in other contexts. But inside of Twitter, I think it's actually extremely valuable because I have lots more people following me in Twitter than I can possibly reciprocate and follow back. But I know that there are certain people who have followed me at some point. I've missed the notification that they're following me, which means I've missed the notification that they're now on Twitter. And yet I'd love to know what they're tweeting, right? I'd love to be able to follow the messages that they're sending out. I do feel bad for them following me because I think most of my Twitters lately have been complaining about rough air travel back and forth from Pittsburgh to San Francisco. But nonetheless, they decided to succumb to that and listen to my complaining. But Mr. Tweet's, I think, been extremely valuable in helping unearth and discover some people who were following me or even people who may not be following me, but especially people who are following me that I missed the opportunity to reciprocate to, but I'm genuinely interested in their in what they're saying and what they're choosing to broadcast in this new communication medium of Twitter.
Yes, so Mingyao Ying, MG, is definitely one of the most amazing people I know. And his depth of thought about how you can rally people behind certain ideas, maybe behind a certain project you want to do, how you can discover people, how you can match people, are among the deepest ideas I know. And I'm actually very happy that he came out with this amazing application called Mr. Tweet, which allows you to discover people. So I, just like you, encourage people to try it out and to give feedback to the questions we have. I have many more questions. I always believe that the questions are more important than the answers. For instance, looking at the whiteboard here, which we have written questions from the top to the bottom here, one of the questions I actually have is, what makes a good discovery a good discovery? Is there more than saying, well, it helps us make better decisions? Not sure about it. Is there more than saying that it's better than the alternative of, let's say in the case of Twitter, we are on day one or maybe day 0.1 in terms of having relevance there? Pretty pathetic. I get the tweets I'm subscribing to in chronological order. Can't be much worse. So I think what makes good discovery? Good discovery is a question which is very, very close to my heart. Discovery could be of content, but it could also be the discovery of people. Because what are the finite goods we have? The finite things we have are time and attention. And to use our attention wisely, to use our time wisely, I think is certainly one of the things which are becoming increasingly important. So in that spirit, I would like to thank our audience for having given us our attention in this podcast.
Absolutely, I would as well. And I would actually love to hear their answers in the comments to what makes good discovery. So we'll be anxiously reading those on the MSpoke blog and taking those in as we continue to try to build out our recommendation engine to do discovery well and build tools around that as well. So thank you very much for your time as well. And thank you, Andreas.
Thank you, Sean.